Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkang namassami. So this is one of the great teachings of the Buddha, the Samaditti Sutta. It's a very famous teaching in its own right because it's very comprehensive. As we go through it, you'll see that this is not actually from the Buddha, but his chief disciple, Sariputta, who is so well regarded, it's put in the whole collection of teachings in the Majjhima Nikaya. And it starts off with just a simple question, and Venerable Sariputta answers it in such a way that leads from one thing to another thing. And through this, we go through the whole of what's known as dependent origination, the famous teaching of Paticca-samuppada, of just the cause and effect nature of existence. So first of all, we're going to the cause and effect nature, that one thing causes another. And especially this is important to understand such teachings as non-self, to understand that this thing which we think of as a mind, as a me, as a consciousness, is a stream which goes according to forces, causes and effects, independent of a being. And it also introduces one of the great ways of analysis in Buddhism, you know, the four parts. What a thing is, what causes it, the very fact that it can cease, and how it ceases. This fourfold division of reality is very well known by most people as the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha singles out suffering. What is it, and what's its cause? That there is an end of suffering, and that what is the cause for the ending of suffering? And they go through the same analysis through four parts in each one of these different aspects which are coming up in this right view teaching. And by doing so, it just elucidates even more powerfully that the teachings of the Buddha is always about you find out any phenomena and find out what causes it. What is this? What causes it? And to realize that it is anicca, it has an ending, it does disappear. And what causes its ending? And understanding this is understanding the full causality of this thing which we call life, not just external phenomena, which is the domain of things like physics, but importantly the inside phenomena, the internal phenomena of consciousness and feeling and perception. Now, what actually is that? How does it come about? The very fact it does have an ending. And how does that ending come about? And you find that this is the core teachings of this particular sutta. And it's called right view because this is the understanding of the great stream winners in Sri Lanka, the soul ones. To understand how this universe works and what is this mind and how is this a causal process. And it's a causal process which has an ending. It can disappear. You are not immortal, says this sutta. So here we go. Samaditti, right view. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove and Natapindika's Park, and some of you have been there on pilgrimage. So whenever I start listening to these suttas and I recall sort of the experience of going to these places, it fills out some of the details. You know these places exist. We know where they are in India. There was too many inscriptions there for us not to miss that these were the places where the Buddha lived, and this is where this was given. There the Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's right-hand monk, addressed the monks thus, "Friends, monks, friend," they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this, "One of right view, one of right view, it is said, friends, in what way is a noble disciple one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unshakable or perfect confidence in a Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma?" And that is the definition of a stream winner. In other words, a stream winner is one who's actually seen this truth. And once they've seen the truth, it's like the shipwrecked sailor who has fell in the ocean and, unlike other shipwrecked sailors, could float around long enough, could actually see where the shore is. He's seen the safety and now can actually start swimming towards that safety. That's a stream winner. To see the way out of rebirth or reincarnation, to see how it's ending, see the Dhamma. And you can see what they're really seeing here is just a cause and effect process dependent origination, non-self, impermanence in the sense that everything, including this thing which is listening to me now, is also impermanent. It can disappear. The monks replied, "Indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the monks will remember it. Then, friends, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend," the monks replied, and then the Venerable said this. That's actually repeated so often, that's just a standard way. You got the introduction here, and the monks said, "Yeah, we'll come from a long way to listen to this," even though they're probably just living in the same monastery, but nevertheless, it's a nice thing to say. And so we start off with the sutta in itself. Start off with a simple statement. First of all, the wholesome and the unwholesome. Wholesome and unwholesome, that's a very difficult word. These days I prefer the skillful and the unskillful. It's kusala and akusala. Skillful means that it's appropriate to the goal, what you're trying to achieve. Now, this is a skillful way of achieving your ends. And the other one is an unskillful way. And this particular first part is to do with virtue. So virtue is a skillful way of leading a life. In other words, it brings you to the goals which you really want in life. You know, the happiness, prosperity, peace. So this is a skillful way of going about it by practicing virtuous conduct. And here we go. The skillful and the unskillful. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the skillful and the root of the unskillful, understands the unskillful and the root of the unskillful, the skillful and the root of the skillful, in that way they are one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what, friends, is the unskillful? What is the root of the unskillful? What is the skillful? What is the root of the unskillful? First of all, the unskillful. Killing living beings, taking what is not given, misconduct in sensual pleasure, false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, gossip, covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. These are unskillful. This is called the unskillful. Those 10 are sometimes called the 10 roots of the 10 unskillful actions. And for those of you who know your Buddhism, you see here the first four of the 5 precepts, with the 4th precept extended not just to lying, but also malicious speech, which is literally malicious gossip, where you tell tales in order to harm another person, to create factions, in other words, to cause disharmony. And harsh speech is calling someone an idiot, crazy, stupid, in other words, just speech which is very harsh to the ear, and coming from usually malice, from ill will. And gossip here, gossip doesn't mean the same word as in English. Gossip means like useless speech, speech without just any real purpose. You're just talking just for the sake of opening your mouth and having a conversation with no real meaning behind it. What we usually mean as gossip would usually be included in malicious speech, where it's malicious gossip, telling tales just to be friendly with one party, spit another party. So it is all right just to sit around a coffee table and discuss things. That's not called gossip. The gossip here is when it's totally useless. Covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. Covetousness is just greed, wanting things. Ill will, you know what ill will is. And wrong view, we're going to find out what wrong view is from this whole teaching. Now, what is the root of the unskillful? Greed, hatred, and delusion is the root of the unskillful. These are called the roots of the unskillful. That greed, hatred, and delusion are called the 3 defilements, the very basic teaching of Buddhism. Because of greed, personal desire, from ill will, and just basic stupidity, not understanding how things work, that means that we do such things as killing living beings, etc., etc. So the root, the main underlying cause is greed, hatred, and delusion. And you may know, just as an aside, that the main delusion is the delusion of a me and a mine, the thing that you own things. So because you own things, so you think you can own things, that's why we have this acquisitiveness called greed. Because we think we can own things, we control things, and control is the cause of frustration which leads to anger and ill will, because we don't get our own way, basically. And of course the delusion is just failing to admit there's nobody in here. And you don't own anything. So that's the root of the unskillful. After I go to the end of this piece, then we can open up for some questions. What is a skillful? And it's the opposite of these. In other words, abstaining from killing living beings. This is intentional killing living beings. It's abstention from stealing, abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures, abstention from false speech, abstention from malicious speech, abstention from harsh speech, abstention from, I'm going to call it like useless speech, abstention from covetousness, abstention from ill will, and a right view. This is called the skillful. Now, what is the root of the skillful? Non-greed. And non-greed is always a metaphor for renunciation, letting go, giving away, is a root of the skillful. Non-hate, and that's always a synonym for metta, loving-kindness, compassion, is a root of the skillful. And non-delusion, what we mean by that is wisdom, is a root of the skillful. This is called the root of the skillful. So when we become wise, when we become compassionate, when we become selfless in the sense of being able to give things away and not accumulative, then that is the root of the skillful. And now, when a noble disciple has thus understood these things, the unskillful, the root of the unskillful, the skillful, and the root of the unskillful, they can entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust, the underlying tendency to aversion. In other words, you're getting right to the root of these things, that why we have ill will, why we have aversion, why we have lust. We can extinguish the underlying tendencies to the view and conceit, I am. So that particular view and thought that I am is abandoned. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, you can here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, is really straight, has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, hasn't arrived at this true Dhamma, who is a stream winner. So this is, first of all, understanding what is skillful, what is unskillful. And it's, again, not just the virtue, but understanding why virtue. Why is it hard for people to keep a virtuous lifestyle? Why do people steal? Why do they kill? Why do they have malicious gossip? Malicious gossip in particular is because, you know, you have conceit. You want to be better than other people. So you say, have you heard, you know, what, say, if I'm a Theravada monk, have you heard what those Mahayana monks are doing? They're hopeless. They're terrible. See, that's conceit. You put down other people to try and raise yourself. All coming from a sense of self. So that's the underlying root which we're trying to overcome. So just understanding, you know, the virtue and understanding why virtue, you're going deep down. It's much more than just virtue. It's more about like the wisdom and why virtue is and why lack of virtue occurs and getting rid of those roots. Once those roots are got rid of and seen, got rid of, you can say you're a stream winner. Oh, so any questions about this so far? Yes, you get a sense of the person. Saying does wrong view create desire, does the desire create wrong view? They do work together. You know, you're a psychologist, you know that wishful thinking, you see what you want to see. And because you want to see what you want to see, then what you see is just creates more desire in you. They often, I teach this to the monks, you know, if you see a beautiful girl come in, you know, nice, young, beautiful, what do you look at? Do you look at her feet? Of course you don't look at her feet, because the feet, you know, it's not particularly beautiful or particularly ugly. It's just feet, that's all. They've got five toes each, and what's the big deal there? So, you know, if you're a man, you look at that part which turns you on. And you want to sort of be turned on. You want to be excited. And that's the whole buzz of sexuality. So you don't look at that part which might sort of destroy the buzz which you're seeking. So, you go on. Yeah. That's what drives. In the end, it's like the ownership of pleasure. You think you can create pleasure and keep it for yourself. And that you can actually control and get rid of sort of the other part of life. But that's like what you think, yeah. So you think you're in control of this life, and if you work hard enough, you get lots of pleasure, and you can sort of avoid at least lessen the pain of life. And you know, you've heard me say before, and it'll come up later during this, all pleasure is just a pause between 2 months of suffering. All suffering is a pause between 2 months of pleasure. And the amount of pleasure which you're experiencing right now is directly related to how much pain has just disappeared and what pain is going to be coming afterwards. So the more pain you just let go of, the more pleasure you feel now. Yes, it's actually worldly joy and unworldly joy, pretty much the same too, but unworldly joy gets a little bit more subtle, but basically the same. It's a duality of pleasure and pain. So I was just saying to, I think, Ramonito the other day, that years and years ago, when I was just reading as a little bit of a hobby some theology, that some theologian, a long time ago, understood enough about the duality of pleasure to say, in Christian heaven, when you go, you know, you worship Jesus or whatever, when you go to heaven, that one day every year, if you're in heaven, you have to go and visit hell. You have to go down and actually see something which you can compare heaven to. Otherwise, you get bored in heaven and take it for granted. And that's actually a very fine point. If you were in some heaven realm, like Perth, Western Australia, you still complain. Because you've got nothing to compare it to. But if anyone, if once a year we took you, say, to Palestine or to the Gaza Strip, then you come back and say, oh, Perth is a wonderful place, it's such a great place, I'm not complaining about anything. I think you can get the point there. So pleasure, you need pain to appreciate pleasure. Without pleasure, there would be no pain. Okay, let's go to number two. And this again is going to some really sort of deep understanding of basic Buddhism, nutriment. Now, nutriment is another word like for fuel. Now, what actually causes things to grow? So again, we're going into cause and effect Buddhism here. Saying, good friends, amongst the light and rejoicing of Venerable Sariputta's words, they asked him, is there another way you can describe right view? I'm abbreviating here because that's a good way in such a long sutta. When, friends, a noble disciple understands nutriment, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, in that way they are one of right view. So this is the first time we've got those four categories. What a thing is, why it is, that there is an end of this thing, and why it ends. That's a basic fourfold way of analysis in Buddhism, which is very powerful. It shows that a thing is not always existing. It's not permanent. You say what it is, and in fact, it can stop. It can cease. It has an ending. What causes it to arise? What causes it to cease? So what is this nutriment? Its origin, cessation, and the way leading to cessation of nutriment. And now we see how the Buddha is using nutriment or fuel. There are four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the support of those seeking a new existence. It's great here. Straight away you see here that the Buddha's not talking about just this life, but beings who want to come into this life. Basically, what keeps them going? What's their source of fuel? And in this life, what keeps a person going? They are what the four? They are physical food, gross or subtle, contact is the sensual contact, volition and consciousness. These are the four nutriments which keep you going. Now, not just in this life, for beings seeking to be. In this life, you can understand this, if you don't have enough food, you die, and that's the body's need. But more than the body, you need some of these mental foods as well, like contact, basically experience. I've often posited, you know, based on this sutta, but also based on my own understandings of the senses, if you are blind and deaf, and you can't feel things in the body, if it's got no sensory contact, you won't be able to exist in this body. Without that sensory contact, you know, you can't have enough momentum, enough fuel to keep this human body going. It will stop. obviously also, the next two are very obvious, volition, sort of will. We all know that people who give up the will to live die. And actually, to keep on going, you have to have that will to live. And you also know the opposite. People who should be dead. You know, the doctors are surprised they're keeping on going. They have the will to live. That sort of will is incredibly strong and can keep you going. And you also know, very, very common, you know, being a monk and having to deal with death as part of my job description, so often it happens, and just, I don't know how many times I've heard this, someone in hospital, they don't die until their brother who's over in New York finally arrives, and they say hello, the next day they're dead. Just waiting, keeping themselves alive because they want to finish this last piece of business. Volition keeps you going. And those people have got no will to live. Even if they, you know, especially when they're on the edge of death, they just die very quickly. And just consciousness feeds on itself. You need that consciousness to keep on going and going and going and going and going. These are the four types of fuel which keeps a human being going. The physical food, which is obvious, but also sensory contact, will, and conscious experience itself. Those three are necessary to keep you going. Not just for beings who are alive, but those who are seeking a new birth. Physical food here is not what they mean, the subtle form of physical food, whatever that is, but certainly contact, those beings seeking a birth, they do have sensory experience, they need to be stimulated. They also have to have the will to live, and the consciousness itself to keep on going. That consciousness is a hard thing to stop. Any one of those four is sufficient for you to get reborn. So if you want to stop getting reborn, which are coming up in a moment, physical food is easy enough to stop. But to stop contact, to withdraw the senses inside in deep meditation, even to stop the mental contact, consciousness itself, to allow it to pause, and to stop the will. So the food, the nutriment of rebirth, is stopped. Then you can nibbana. You can cease. As it says down here. With the arising... Oh, sorry, first of all, those are the four. What causes these four? With the arising of this craving, this wanting, there is the arising of the nutriment. It's the craving to be. Keeps you going. With the cessation of the craving, there's the cessation of the nutriment. And the way leading to the cessation of this nutriment for being, surprise, surprise, is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and right stillness. You know my preferred translation now for samadhi, not concentration, but stillness. By developing these things, especially the last one, stillness, you can understand that stillness stops the volition, ends the contact, and even pacifies the consciousness until things really stop. And there is the end of nutriment and the end of existence. When a noble disciple has thus understood this nutriment, its origin, cessation, where it into its cessation, you can entirely abandon the underlying tendency to greed, aversion. You can extinguish the underlying tendency of the viewing conceit, I am. You see how the whole thing works, how you keep on going, why that you keep on getting reborn, what powers you through even this life. When you see the source of the energy, you can understand what it creates. This I is not a being, it's just a process created by nutriment. So you can take off the underlying tendency to the view and can see I am. And by thus abandoning ignorance, the delusion of a self, and arousing true knowledge, you here and now make an end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this Dhamma. perfect confidence because you've seen it. Seen it in the deepest sense, usually in your deep meditations, when the hindrances are totally gone. Because the hindrances are totally gone, that which distorts your understanding is gone. And it's very clear, very true, unshakable. Comments on that? Okay, we go to the next one. Now, the very famous Four Noble Truths. Saying, good friends, amongst delight and rejoice in the Sariputta's words, they ask him, can there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view? Yes, there might be, friends, said Sariputta. When, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, dukkha, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to cessation of suffering. In that way, they're one of right view, one who's arrived at this true Dharma. And this is the one which most of us know, under the fourfold scheme, what it is, why it is, that it has an ending, and why it has an ending. And most people are more interested in how to end suffering, and to know there is an end of suffering, than they are to really know about nutriments, which is why this is the most famous of these things under the fourfold scheme. And first of all, suffering is suffering. It is by far the best translation, translating in other words like disappointment, whatever. It is suffering. So, when, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, the origin, they've arrived at this true Dhamma. So what is suffering? Its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Birth is suffering. And that always needs to be paused at. It's not the process of birth, because, you know, that's baby coming out of the womb, that might hurt. It's the very fact that you're born again. You exist again, you've got another whole life to endure. If you really understand just what you've done by getting reborn again, you understand what the Buddha said, birth is suffering. Once you're born, you've got the karma from the past. So in fact, you want to be reborn again, and it hurts. It's something much better than being reborn in any realm. Birth is suffering. When you know the opposite of what's possible, not being born, they understand why this sucks. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering. That's pretty obvious. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Not to attain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected, or rather caused by clinging, are suffering. This is called dukkha. And sometimes people get stuck on this one. They say, yeah, but life is not always suffering, that you monks are just really weird, you really need to go and see a psychologist and get a more positive view about life. There's many wonderful things to do in this world, instead of just thinking life is suffering, 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 suffering. True, but when you go and look at those things, it's still suffering. I just was looking at some quotes I wrote down many years ago, and there's a great quote by Oscar Wilde, who said that there are only two forms of suffering in this world. This is Oscar Wilde's Two Noble Truths. And the first form of suffering is not getting what you want. And the second form of suffering is getting what you want. The two forms of suffering in life. And that was very wise. Because those of you who've got what you want, you find out it's not what I really wanted. And it's so disappointing. As soon as you achieve your goal, are you happy? No, you have to go and find another goal. Another bar to jump over. So, it's not really satisfying. And that's why getting what you want, sometimes it's even worse suffering than not getting it. When you're not getting it, you live in hope. And hope drives you forward. When you get what you want, you get disappointed. But actually, they both are what we call suffering. You ask people who've won the lotto, people who've become famous, they've done the recording, and they're part of a world-famous group. Whatever it is, whatever people aspire to in the world, once they get it, so what? So those are sufferings in life. And there's something much more than that. And I keep on mentioning, once you get into deep meditation, you really see that even seeing is suffering, hearing is suffering, smelling, tasting, having a body, and experiencing senses is suffering. because you just get into the jhanas and you don't have any physical feelings anymore. You can't, these five senses completely suppressed. Oh, that's just such bliss. Just not having to feel, not having to see, not having to hear. Just being deep in the mind. That's just wonderful. Just peace. And you come back and just this body is just, wow, it's just such a pain. If it's not in deep meditation, you just ask anybody who's had a near-death experience floating out of their body and they have to come back to their body again for some reason. And they know what it's like not to have a body. Oh, it's just such a pain to come back into this body again. So this body is suffering, but because we're used to it, we don't know anything other than our body, we were born in this and we can't remember anything before that, that's why that sometimes we think, oh, this body's not that bad. But it is. It's a pain. That's why birth is suffering. These five aggregates, they're suffering. Even like the fourth aggregate, sankhara, otherwise known as will, it's suffering. And sometimes people, no, I want to choose. I want to have the ability to control my whole life and environment. And that's actually suffering. We take control to be a freedom, but really it is a prisoner. So it is a prison guard, it's a torturer. We've got so much choice these days. Go in shops. Just go on the internet. How many things can you choose and can you buy? You've got so much choice and so much actual suffering. Just took Venuanito in this weekend with me, and he had not full play, but a lot of play on the internet. There you can see just how much choice and how much suffering that is in your head. You know, having to be able to do things. It's much nicer when we don't have internet access at our monastery. Oh, it's so much more peaceful when you can't choose where you're going to... What does Microsoft say? Where are you going to go to today? You can stay where you are instead of going somewhere else. And again, in deep meditation, when you go to second jhana, will is gone. You can't choose anything. What a relief that is. That's why I've often given a simile that you are in a cell in a prison. The walls of that prison are the five senses, the five big walls. And you're caught in the sense of self, a sense of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. You can't get beyond those five prison walls. That's your life. And you have a prison guard, a torturer, always pushing you around, telling you what to do. And that's called will. And you think that that will is you. It's not, it's a torturer. It's nothing to do with you. But your choice, will, decisions, always pushing you around. Telling you what to do, telling you off when you make a mistake, never giving you peace. Even when you meditate, will, what should I do next? It's not coming from you, that's coming from this will. Stopping you, calming down, and being still. That's why five khandhas are suffering. And I just pointed out one of them. Just intention, will. Powerful. So, that's what suffering is. And what's the origin of suffering? Craving again. Wanting. It's this craving in particular here, which brings renewal of being, otherwise known as rebirth. That's what renewal of being is. It's that craving which brings rebirth, which is accompanied by delight and lust, ever delighting in this or that. That is, craving for sensory pleasures, which is the five senses, I want more. Craving for being. Even if you don't want pleasures, you just want to be. I want to exist. And that's by far the deepest of the cravings. And the craving to annihilate yourself, which you just cannot do. The Buddha described that like a dog chasing its tail. And this is sometimes Buddhists get caught in that last one. To crave to annihilate themselves, to try and stop. But every will to stop is another type of controlling. It's another will. You don't crave to stop. You stop the craving. That's called the origin of suffering. And what is the cessation of suffering? Suffering can stop. There is an end. And it is the remainingness, fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of suffering. So the craving just stops. And it's really the craving is suffering. It literally means the word for craving is also for thirst. If you're really, really thirsty, just this pain inside you, you have to slake that thirst. That is the ending of suffering. Otherwise known as Nibbana. Otherwise known as Paramangsukhang, the ultimate happiness, the end of suffering. And what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? Here we go again, the Eightfold Path. As we said before, when a noble disciple has thus understood what dukkha really is, where it comes from, how it's generated, the cessation of suffering, and how to end suffering, you become a stream winner. And you here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, to a noble disciple is one of right view. If you understand what's going on, gee, all this time, I thought that this world was a wonderful place. Playing around in it, world is my oyster, life is a bowl of cherries. When you actually see what's going on, or why this is, they say, gee, I can see it, there is an end to it, I know how to get out, and of course you get out. Once you know you're in prison, the door of that prison cell is always open. You can walk through any time you want, if you really want to. But we don't want to, because we like our prison. It's very similar to those of you who have read my book and know the last story, The Worm in the Pile of Shit. And you know that story, acted it out on the New Year's Eve. And the worm doesn't want to go, because it likes its shit. Just like the person in suffering. We're so used to our shit, we don't want to leave it. It's warm and it's fragrant. And that is the biggest part. Once you realize you're in shit, then you might sort of decide to get out. And being a stream winner, the attainment of stream winners is really realizing you are in shit. So it's time to get out. I'm being quite coarse, speaking in the local language, but I hope you understand. Any comments? Yes. That's right. It's more like, if I was translating that, I wouldn't say death, I'd say dying is suffering. The dying process. So up until the point of death. That sort of, from the time that you know you're going and it's just death is inevitable in front of you, then the whole process of dying is suffering. It's very rare to actually see a person who is actually totally at peace with their death. Sometimes you see one. A good example is, just talking with Chi Wei this morning, there's an article on the board over there about Venerable Kesavi Dhammananda. Many of his books are out there. But when he was told he had cancer and was terminal, and the doctor reported after, he's never seen a person respond like this, he burst out laughing. That's really good, Mike. So, I don't know if you've ever been told by your doctor you've got cancer and it's terminal, but can you burst out laughing? It's a nice response, isn't it? So, ah, I'm dying. He thought, wow, whee, I'm out of here. Okay. Aging and death. Saying, good friends, amongst the life you rejoice in the venerable Sariputta's words. Then they ask him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view? There might be friends. When a noble disciple understands aging and death, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of aging and death. In that way, you could say there are one of right view, one has arrived at the true Dharma. Now, what is aging and death? Its origin, cessation, the way leading to its cessation. And it's nice here that sometimes when we talk about death and aging, there are some monks, and they're good monks, who start to say, well, what we really mean, don't really mean about the real death. We talk about being attached to dying. Not real aging, but being attached to aging. No, it's aging itself. Well, they try and escape from the obvious by saying, well, it's not really the aging of a body, it's just every moment ages, every moment dies, and you're reborn in the next moment. Yes, that's okay, but that's not what the Buddha meant. When the Buddha taught, he was very precise, you know, because obviously wanted to make sure that there was no doubt what the Buddha meant. And here we actually see what the Buddha meant by aging and dying. Later on we come to what birth is. It's not birth in the moment. It's birth, you know, from a mother's womb. So what is aging and death? The aging of beings in their various orders of beings, not just human beings. their old age, brokenness of teeth, greyness of hair, wrinkling of the skin. They didn't have Botox in those days. Decline of life, weakness of faculties. This is called aging. Now, this is classic aging. The decline of life, the weakness of faculties. You all know just when people get old, you know, that you can't hold your hands still. You get Parkinson's disease. You can't walk instead of with a walker or a stick. You get weak legs, weak arms, weak eyes, weak ears. You know, you have to use hearing aids. I've often said the one part of an old person which gets stronger, the older they are, their mouth. Old people can talk much more than young people. So that's one part of the faculty which gets stronger the older you are. So you can always tell how old people are by how much they talk. Anyway, that's the weakness of weakness in decline of life, weakness of faculties, that's called aging. The passing of beings out of the various orders of beings. They're passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of the aggregates. Laying down of the body, that's called death. The Buddhists may say it's real death, not like some metaphysical death, but the real death, what most people call death. So the aging and this death are what is called aging and death. With the arising of birth, that is the arising of aging and death. Basically, because you're born, that's why you die. And with the cessation of birth, there's a cessation of aging and death. And the way leading to the cessation of aging and death is just the Eightfold Path again. So basically, once you're born, you're going to have aging and death. It's quite obvious, you can't escape from that. That's why when you're born, it's a bit too late in this lifetime. So the only thing you can do is to make sure you aren't born again. Noble disciple has thus understood aging and death, the origin, cessation, and the way into cessation of aging and death, you now, here and now, make an end of suffering. In that way, noble disciple is one of the right views arrived at this true Dhamma. I'll just go through birth a bit, and then we'll just pause for maybe questions. So in good friends, the monks delight and rejoice in the Venerable Sai Buddha's words, and they ask, may there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view? There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands birth. The origin, the cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of birth. In that way, they're one of right view. And the variety of this true Dhamma. This is an important point here. There is a way to end birth. The Buddha is saying here, there is a cessation of birth. You don't have to sort of keep on being born. The way to end aging and death is to end birth. And this becomes almost the main purpose why the person who was to become the Buddha left his home and he was seeking an end of birth. So that would be his last life and he wouldn't be reincarnated anymore. That was his whole purpose of leaving home, doing 6 years of ascetic practices and eventually sitting under a Bodhi tree to find a way to end this thing called birth, to stop the cycle of rebirth, to end samsara. So what is birth, its origin, what is its cessation? What is the way leading to cessation of birth? Here we go, birth, not birth in a moment. The birth of beings in the various orders of beings. They're coming to birth, precipitation in a womb, generation, manifestation of aggregates, obtaining the sense basis, the basis for contact. This is called birth. In other words, birth as we know it. With the cessation of being, there's the cessation of birth. Great. As long as there's being there, you'll always get born somewhere. There's this sense of being, existing. This causes you to be reborn. Until you can actually see through that, you'll always get born. Are you? Do you assume that you are? If you say yes to that, you will never end samsara. Being is the cause of birth. Says the Buddha here. So being is the cause of birth. Where are we going here? With the arising of being is the arising of birth. With the cessation of being is the cessation of birth. Phew. And the way leading to the cessation of birth, the Noble Eightfold Path. Again. When noble disciples thus understood birth, its origin, there is a cessation of birth. And the way leading to the cessation of birth, you can now, here and now, make an end of suffering. You're a stream winner, you're on the way out. You understand what birth is and how it's ending. You understand how much suffering it is. And you understand how to stop it, of course. you're going to stop it. It's only a matter of time. Pause for questions or comments. Okay, let's go on. Those are the five aggregates, the five khandhas. That's the body, that's the feeling, perception. That's the feeling, is the smell, but it's not volition and consciousness. When these things, they disappear at the end of life, or they manifest at the beginning of life, you've got a new consciousness, the baby or the young kitten with its faculties. Just arise there. That's the arising of a being. And its death is a dissolution of the faculties. You look at that dead sort of cat or something, you could poke it, it's got no consciousness, making no response to what you're doing. You look in its eyes, so which is what doctors sometimes do, shine a light, see if there's any movement, any response there. The sense of sight isn't working anymore. Put an MRI, or not MRI, a brain scan, whatever, and there's no brain activity anymore. There's no manifestation of any faculties. Death. And arising is when there's birth. So now, being, this thing called bhava. Saying, good friends, amongst delight and rejoicing of Venerable Sariputta's words, I ask, is there another way you might talk about right view? Yes, there is. When, friends, a noble disciple understands being, the origin of being, the cessation of being, and the way leading the cessation of being, in that way they're one of right view, one is the right of this true Dharma. What is being? What's its origin, its cessation, a way into a cessation? There are these three types of being or existence. Sense-sphere being, fire-material being, and immaterial being. Now what does that actually mean? Sense-sphere being, this is the being in the karma loka, K-long-A-M-A. Not the same as karma as the word like actions or the law of karma. This is another word which sounds the same, but it's completely different. This is the world of the five senses. Five sense being is what you're used to. You only see a fraction of the five sense beings. That five sense being also includes the ghost realm, which do exist, hell realms, deva realms, animal realms. That's sense beings where you're working on five senses or the equivalents in these finer states. Devas and ghosts can see, can hear. But what we call with a mind-made body, a manomayakaya, which is again, has the faculties, a different way of seeing. Similar to again, those people who have NDEs, near-death experiences, floating out of the body, even though the body they're using is not their physical body, it's a mind-made body. It can still see and hear, even feel. That's the type of being in those realms. And the other two realms, the fine material being, that's the realm which is generated by the jhanas. These are the two which are just mind. Mind beings. And to actually understand that such a state exists, you have to get into those deep meditations and to know what we're talking about by fine material being. And to know that just the person who knows those states, understands those states, has familiarity with those states, can get reborn into those states. And can exist there as a type of being, just pure mind, without the physical stuff. And the immaterial being is even more refined, still a pure mind being, but based on perceptions, nothing else. You can still exist there. The fuel for those states, going back to that first one, the nutriments. The nutriments is not the physical food anymore. The fine food which maintains those states is piti, joy. These are sometimes what the Buddha called pitibhaka satta. These are beings who feed on joy. This is their nutriment, not physical food, but just the joy of that experience. Keeps it rolling. The contact, the sensory contact, is just pure mind contact. Volition. It's the volition which was inherent in attaining that experience in the beginning. I once described that to Venerable Guru Naratana as like an arrow which has been shot. Hasn't hit the target yet, so it hasn't finished its journey. But it carries the volition, the aim of the archer. So even in those jhanas, there is still a sense of volition there. it's carried the aim of the person who's got into that state, but now the arrow is in full flight. You can't change its course. So the volition is the inherent, or is the volition which is carried from that time, the meditator sort of entered that jhana and keeps it going for that particular length of time. That's the volition, the kanda, which keeps that particular fine material state or immaterial state going. And obviously the consciousness. In these states, you're not unconscious, it's not a trance. These are full consciousness, very clear, very profound. But just the sixth sense, mind consciousness. These are the three areas of being. And what is the cause, where these things come from? With the arising of clinging, there's the arising of being. This word clinging is upadana. Sometimes people call it attachment. Again, my preferred translation, which is very legitimate, is fuel. Upadana is a fuel. It literally means, and some of you may know this, you don't have to be Pali scholars, you know the word adana, from the adinadana, taking what's not given. The upa, adana. Adana is exactly the same, it's taking. And the upa, many of the ancient Pali words have got their equivalent in English. It literally does mean taking up. Upa adana, or adana, taking, and up, as in upa, exactly the same. It literally means taking up. So understanding what this word really means, the taking up, you can see that can be a clinging. I'm now taking up this gong bonger. I'm holding it, I'm clinging it, I'm taking up. If I let it go, I'm not taking up anymore. But also, just as a flame takes up the oil, as the fan takes up the electricity, that's what we mean by a taking up, a fuel which a being takes up to give it an existence, to give it being. And this is with the arising of this taking up. We find out what it's taking up in a few moments. With taking up, there is the arising of being. And with the where's it gone? With the cessation of taking up, there's a cessation of being. And now you see why that idea of taking up becomes much better than clinging. When you stop taking things up, being stops. All these types of beings. You can see just how the sense of self, the sense of existence, always takes up things. So the more it takes up, the more solid that sense of being is. And what's the way to the cessation of being? This is Noble Eightfold Path. So if you're practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, it says here very clearly, you are ceasing being. This is the suicide path. Big time. This is not Exit International. This is Buddhism. Dignitas, that clinic in Switzerland where people commit euthanasia, that's not the real place. Dhammaloka Buddhist Center, Bodhinyana Monastery, Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, and all these other great places where you can meditate and end everything. That's the real place where you get out of samsara. Exit International, big time. Right here at Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. You want to get out quickly while you've still got time? See what's happening next. Well, Noble Disciples thus understand being, its origin, cessation, way into cessation. You can now, here and now, make an end of suffering, end of rebirth. And that way you're one of the right viewers attended the right of this true Dhamma. Now what this is taking up, here called clinging, this upadana. Saying, good friends, amongst delight and rejoicing in the Venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question. But friend, might there be another way where you can be a one of right view? Yes, there can be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands taking up, the origin of taking up, the cessation of taking up, and the way leading to cessation of taking up, in that way they're one of right view. And what is taking up? What is its origin, cessation, the way leading to cessation? There are these four kinds of taking up. Taking up of sensory pleasures. Taking up of views. Taking up to rules and observances. Taking up a doctrine, a belief in a self. Those are the four types of taking up. You can see these create that sense of being. the more you take up sensory pleasures, the more solid is yourself. They have this old simile, this creation myth in Buddhism, about these beings, very fine beings, who came to the earth and started eating the savory earth when it first formed. And because they started getting into these sensory pleasures, their bodies became not subtle anymore, but more solid and more gross. It's a wonderful little metaphor of how the more sensory pleasures you take up, the more gross, solid is your sense of being. Which is why sometimes people don't want to give up their sensory pleasures. It is like they start to disappear. With the... What else is there? Sorry. Four kinds of taking up. The taking up of views. You can see just when you take up a view, and you can take up sort of Jesus is the only way view. It's one of the reasons why that sometimes fundamentalism. Why do people become fundamentalists? Either fundamentalist Jews, fundamentalist Muslims. Anyone who takes up that view and they cling to it and they feed on that, they have a very, very strong sense of self. And you can actually see that they get a power from that. That's one of the drugs of those very, very hard views. If you don't take up that view sort of in religion, if you take it up sort of in even sort of politics, and you become like a communist, become a diehard, that's who I am, you get a huge amount of energy from that. But that energy is quite negative. It's the energy of a self. You make a very, very solid person out of that, which is one of the reasons why it's attractive to people. They are somebody. It's not quite a question of feeling they belong. It's feeling they are. Yeah, it's true. I mean, you are the... It can, because your sense of self, if you're the Prime Minister, you're Mr. Boss, you're the President, you're number one. So, of course, that does create sort of the sense of, a strong sense of self, of being. That's why, you know, Lord Acton power corrupts. And it corrupts the sense of self. And if you're the boss, of course you don't listen to other people. That's not your role anymore. You know, you're the one who's elected. You're better than other people. If you're the monk, the great teacher, you've got to be very careful because you can make mistakes. And of course I make mistakes. I make silly statements, not just silly jokes. Sometimes you make mistakes when you're teaching. But you have to admit those mistakes. If you think, I am the great teacher, I am the infallible pope, then you actually make a strong sense of self, but it does make you, can make you angry and upset when other people question you. Which is one of the reasons that, you know, understanding this, you try and ask people, please question, please argue. Because that keeps me and any other teacher honest. And, okay. Clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances. Really, that's usually explained as clinging to the idea that through rules and observances you can become enlightened this way. But it does actually say just rules and observances. Sometimes I really just wonder whether that does actually mean just itself, that you use the rules and observances as a fuel for who you are. Certainly you can see a priest becomes a priest because of the rules and observances. The rites and rituals which you can perform, and only you can perform those. So maybe those rules and observances, it doesn't mean what it says. Just the rules and observances do create that sense of self, do create that solidity, that taking up. And lastly, clinging to a doctrine of self. Just basically that's the underlying taking up. Taking up the view, the doctrine, I am. And of course, with I am, as it says elsewhere by the Buddha, When there is a doctrine of self, an idea of me, there will always be what you possess. Not just I am, but I own. When there's a me, there will always be a mine. And you can't have one without the other. So said the Buddha. And I really agree with that, obviously, but see that myself. So when there's a doctrine of self, there'll always be a doctrine of ownership. If it's not just material things, it can be mental, spiritual things. Your reputation, your knowledge, your happiness, and in particular, your will. I am, therefore I own my will. When a noble disciple, with the arising of craving, there is the arising of this taking up. With the cessation of craving, there's a cessation of taking up. And the way into the cessation of taking up, Noble Eightfold Path again. It's obvious because, you know, when you do this Noble Eightfold Path, you're letting go, you're not taking up things anymore. That's why letting go, letting things be, is probably the most common word you hear here. You hear in any sort of Buddhist discourse. It's not taking up, it's letting things go. Renouncing. Open the door of your heart. In other words, you're just letting things be. Next one, craving. Saying, good friends, amongst the life and rejoicing of Venerable Sai Buddha's words, they ask him a further question. May there be another way? Yes. When friends, a noble disciple understands craving, origin, cessation, way leading to cessation of craving, and that way they are too one of right view. And what is craving? What is its origin? Its cessation, way leading to cessation of craving. Now you hear another definition of craving, not just the craving under the Four Noble Truths. They say there are six classes of craving. Craving for forms, this is with your eye. Craving for sounds with your ear, craving for odors with your nose, craving for flavors with your tongue, craving for tangibles with your body, the nice sensations. Craving for mind objects, your mind. So these are the six classes of craving. Basically, craving for sensory experience. That type of craving takes up things. When you take up things, you create existence. You're taking up sensory experience, causing existence, being, which will cause rebirth. With the arising of feeling, and I mentioned, we'll go to feeling afterwards, feeling is not emotional feeling, it's, I should really mention now that with every of these six senses, there is a pleasant, unpleasant, or in-between. I know that sometimes we actually talked somewhere recently about in-between feeling, and really, it's such a small thing, almost like a line between two huge areas, like a border between two countries. It really hardly says it exists at all. It's usually pleasurable or painful, pleasant or unpleasant. In between, you're looking at me very clearly, and it's either a bit more pleasant than unpleasant, or a bit more unpleasant than pleasant. It's usually pleasant or unpleasant. So, that's feeling. So with the arising of this feeling, there's the arising of craving sometimes, where there's the delusion there as well. And with the cessation of the feeling, there's a cessation of craving. The way into the cessation of this craving is this Noble Eightfold Path. When noble disciples understand craving, its origin, cessation, way into a cessation, you can now, here and now, make an end of suffering. In this way, to a noble disciple is one of right view, one is the right of this true Dhamma. So, somehow, we've got to end this craving, and the Buddha said, by ending feeling. This is one of those difficult ones, because it's not just feeling. Even the arahat, the enlightened one, still experiences pleasure and pain, but it doesn't cause craving, it doesn't cause taking up, it doesn't cause being. Because you see, the enlightened one will not take up that as a cause for being. But anyway, any questions, comments? Yeah? Yeah. Example, okay, I'm going to get into trouble here, just reciting the word Amitabha, Amitabha, Amitofo, Amitofo, thinking you can become enlightened that way. It's very nice to think so, but unfortunately you need much more than that. Or thinking that we can have some sort of ceremony. Some sort of ceremony, I can do some magic chant for you, and you become enlightened as a result. or I can touch you on the forehead and you can see the Dhamma. So sometimes there are rites and rituals which people believe will actually change things for them. So they can help, but it's not good enough. You need something much deeper than just rites and rituals. That's why you can see our forest tradition is just the most ritual-free of just about any Buddhism which I know. Even the Zen Buddhists, they still have all these fish and this chanting which they do, and they have a stick which I have to hit you with. You ask them why, because that's what my master did. So it's still rites and rituals, very much so. The forest tradition, we just really try and keep it to the absolute minimum, if just get rid of all of them if we possibly could. Yes? A good, sorry? Buddhist view is great, but the Buddhist view is the view which will end such things as views. So, we're going to the very deepest part of Buddhism here. This is actually how to become fully enlightened. So you can have a view as a sort of a temporary, sort of makeshift idea, like a map. If you compare views to maps, but when you get to the map, some of the maps are wrong. Or some maps, like the UBD, doesn't go as far as Bodhinyana Monastery. So you'd look in your UBD and find out where a monastery is, and you won't find it on there, because maps are limited. In the same way that views can be so limited, and you may have all these views, but it doesn't actually include Nibbana yet. So that's why views, you can use them as approximations, but don't take them too seriously. It's because of views we argue with each other. Because of views we have Mahayana Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism, Baptists, you name just how many sort of sects which divide humanity. Why? Because of views. So if you take up a view, don't use it to divide yourself from other people. So, feeling. Saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable disciple Buddha's words, they asked him, is there another way? Yes, there might be. When friends, the noble disciple understands feeling, origin, cessation, or way into cessation of feeling, there can be one of right view. And what is feeling? What is its origin, cessation, or way into cessation? There are these six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, bind of mind contact. So this is the feelings, pleasure or the pain, which arise in any of these six sense bases. Because of that, they can generate craving. The craving can generate taking up. Taking up generates a sense of being, an existence. With the arising of contact, basically the senses being turned on, there's the arising of feeling. The cessation of contact, the cessation of feeling. The way in the cessation of feeling is this Noble Eightfold Path. When the Noble Eight disciples thus understood this feeling, the origin, cessation, way into cessation of feeling, they can here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, to a noble disciple is one of right views or others true Dhamma. People think you can control feeling, you can control pleasure or pain, but it's just a thing which when an unpleasant object contacts your sense, you get an unpleasant feeling. It's understanding what feeling is, that basically it's out of control. You're going to have pain, you're going to have pleasure, no matter what you do. Understanding that means you stop craving, you stop worrying about it so much. The old simile of my driverless bus, when you find is, you know, your bus, you, there's no driver in that seat, it means you stop complaining when things go well, when things don't go so well, that's life. You can have your pleasurable time, you have your painful time, your grief and your happiness. You can have all of that. So, you haven't made a mistake, life isn't wrong. So you just have to accept that pleasure and pain is completely out of control. So stop your craving for these things. When you're having a rotten time, stop complaining. When you're having a wonderful time, don't think, wow, at last I've got it right. You haven't got it right, nothing to do with you. So just let it go. Contact. Saying, good friends, amongst the lights and rejoice in the venerable side Buddha's words, there's another way you can explain right view. Yes, there is. When, friends, a noble disciple understands contact, origin, cessation, way leading to cessation of contact, you want a right view. And what is contact? It's origin, cessation, way leading to its cessation. there are the six classes of contact. You know, basically your sense of sight turning on, ear turning on, nose turning on, tongue turning on, body turning on, and mind turning on, mind contact. With the arising of the sixfold base, there is the cessation of, is the arising of contact. The cessation of the sixfold base, the six senses, basically, that there's a cessation of contact. And the way leading to the cessation of contact is this Noble Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path just turns off all sensory experiences. When noble disciples have understood contact, its origin, cessation, way leading to the cessation, then they become one of right view, a disciple who has arrived at this true Dhamma. The sixfold base, saying, good friend, the monks delight and rejoice in the venerable disciple Buddha's words. They ask him, is there another way? Yes, there is. When friends, a noble disciple understands the sixfold base, its origin, cessation, and way leading to its cessation. They are one who has arrived at this true Dhamma, one of right view. What is this sixfold base? Its origin, cessation, the way leading to its cessation. There are these six bases, six senses. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. With the arising of this mentality, materiality, nama rupa, which is coming next, there is the arising of the sixfold base. With cessation of nama rupa, there is a cessation of sixfold base. The way leading to the cessation of these six senses is the eightfold path. When noble disciples thus understood the sixfold base, the origin, cessation, and the way leading to cessation of the sixfold base, they here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, too, an old disciple is one of right view who has arrived at this true Dhamma. I'm just going fast here because running short of time. Saying, good friends, the monks delight and rejoice in the venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view? There might be friends. When friend, an noble disciple understands, it's called Nama Rupa, mentality of materiality. The origin of Nama Rupa, the cessation of Nama Rupa, and the way leading to the cessation of Nama Rupa. In that way, they're one of right view. One's arrived at the true Dhamma. Remember, Nama Rupa is the cause of the six senses, which is the cause of contact, which is the cause of feeling, which can create craving, which can create this taking up and making a being. And what is Nama Rupa, its origin, cessation, the way leading to cessation? Now this is an important part here because many people have an argument of what Nama Rupa is. The Abhidharma is completely against what it says here. This is where we say the Abhidharma was wrong. Abhidharma makes a huge mistake here and confuses a huge number of people. But here we have what's in the suttas. What is Nama Rupa? Feeling. This is the Vedana again. Perception. Volition. Contact and attention. These are called mentality. If you look at that, that's basically the second, third, and fourth of the five khandhas. The Buddha actually said that fourth khandha, sankhara, is mainly about volition. So this is the mentality, materiality. This is the feeling, the pleasure and pain, the perception, the will. Senses being contact and paying attention to things. That's called mentality, according to Sariputta. And these are the things, because of the volition, the contact, attention, these actually create, keep the six sense spaces going. And the four great elements, material form derived from these four great elements, these are called materiality. That's the first khanda. So mentality, materiality, those two together are what's called Nama Rupa. So these are volition, feelings, this is going to the deep causes here. With the arising of consciousness, there is the arising of mentality, materiality. With the cessation of consciousness, it's a cessation of mentality, materiality. With the way into the cessation of Nama Rupa, it's just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view to right samadhi, right stillness. Now the difference here between what's said here and the Abhidharma is the Abhidharma include consciousness in Nama Rupa. But it's quite clear here that consciousness is separated out from Nama Rupa by the Buddha. If those of you who really get into this, that makes a huge difference in your understanding. Which is why this is another place where the Abhidharma is not in accordance with the suttas. But we leave that aside for a minute. This is Nama Rupa. And one of the important things here is to understand that when there's consciousness, there's the arising of this Nama Rupa. When consciousness ceases, Nama Rupa ceases. Now that's got an interesting important point there, is when there's consciousness, there has to be feeling, perception, the rupa, the things to feel and see, contact and attention. You can't have consciousness without these things. From consciousness, these things are generated. And I make this really point here because sometimes people think they can have a consciousness without being conscious of something. You can have some sort of like disembodied consciousness, or sometimes they call it non-manifest consciousness, or whatever. And these are little words, which is complete mistranslations of what the Buddha was actually talking about. You can't have consciousness without feeling, and feeling is pleasure or pain. If you have consciousness, you're going to have the whole realm of suffering, the pleasure, the pain, the perceptions, the will, all these things which the Buddha clearly made as suffering. If there's consciousness, there is suffering. So you can't think that enlightenment is some form of conscious existence where there's no more suffering. To be conscious is to suffer. Full stop. This is the import of what's said here. Yeah? Certainly you can. You can have, this is actually in those formless realms. You can have consciousness with the other three khandhas. You always have to have feeling, perception, and these mental formations such as volition, such as attention, such as contact. Those always have to be there. You can have it without the physical form, which is what happens in the jhana realms. But you still have consciousness, you're still conscious of something. This is why that, not here but elsewhere, this is in the Mahanidana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha said this, nama rupa and consciousness, they're like two sheaves of reeds leaning against each other. If you take, this is sorry, Sanyutta Nikaya, if you take one of those sheaves away, the other one falls down. You can't have consciousness without nama rupa. You can't have nama-rupa without consciousness. Very clear, the simile of the sheaves of reeds in the Sanghita Nikaya, said by the Buddha. I mention that because sometimes people think that enlightenment is some sort of consciousness where you're not really conscious of anything. If you're not really conscious of anything, you're not conscious. There's no consciousness. Okay, and with the cessation of consciousness, there's the cessation of nama-rupa. A way into cessation of mentality and materiality is this Noble Eightfold Path. Noble disciples thus understood nama rupa, its origin, cessation, way into its cessation. They've now, here and now, made an end of suffering. And that way too, a disciple is one of right view and is right with his true Dhamma. Now, consciousness. Here is not just some airy-fairy idea, but it's very clear what consciousness means. Saying, good friends, amongst the light of rejoicing in the Venerable Sai Buddha's words, may there be another way to describe right view. There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands consciousness, its origin, cessation, and the way leading to a cessation of consciousness. In that way, they are one of right view. One has arrived at the true Dhamma. So what is consciousness, its origin, cessation, way leading to a cessation? First of all, I'll just have a divergence here on the Pali word vijnana. And the word, the prefix V, that's in English, it's bi, it means like twofold, it's a splitting up, like bicycle, like bifurcation, like biped, two feet, or two legs. Because, the English is an Indo-Aryan language, so, we have a lot of words which are similar. So, vijnana, literally means like two knowings. It means like a discriminating sort of knowing, where you have to know two things. You can never know one thing. So all consciousness is dualistic. Has to be. So when people start talking about non-dualism, if you really understand what non-dualism is and enter non-dualism, consciousness stops. You can only be conscious of changing things. From your basic experience, the sound of the fan, because it's been going on such a long time, before I mentioned it to you, you weren't conscious of it, because it didn't change. Things which don't change, which are always there, you can't know. But here, what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness with the six senses: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. Pause. Consciousness isn't just one thing. There's six completely different classes of consciousness. However, as I said in my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, the nature of our experience is we hear something and then we know we heard it. We see something, we know we've seen it. Usually we have, for every sensory experience, the mind consciousness comes up right afterwards. So as we see, then we know. We see again, we know again. We see again, we know again. We hear, we know. We feel, we know. We sort of taste, we know. We smell, we know. And even we know, and then we know, we know. Actually, we know, we knew. The idea knowledge of self, this sense of identity. You know, the I think, therefore I am. That really should be, I thought, and I know I thought. When you add time into that, you understand why there is a sense of self-identity. You never know that you know. You know that you knew. If you add that past tense in there, you've had one mental experience, then you know you've had that mental experience. Then the whole illusion is sometimes broken about why we think we exist. So when you see there's different types of consciousness, and you can split those up. The other simile I gave was like the beach. You look at a beach from a distance, you think it's a continuous stretch of sand. That your consciousness seems to be continuous from moment to moment, which is why we have a delusion of self, that I am the one who knows. It's always there. It's continuous, your ability to know. But in sand, if you look more closely, you see the grains of sand, particles. And you look more closely, they're not even touching. They're actually spaces between those grains of sand. And if you look closely at the flow of your conscious experience, this is again what you see. Sight consciousness, and it finishes. And then knowledge, no, comes up. And then that finishes, and there's a gap between them. There's nothing which goes across. That too starts to challenge your sense of identity. That which was conscious a few moments ago is the same as that which is conscious right now. Start to really know what consciousness is. There's six different types of consciousness. And when there's one of these, the other one is gone. You can't smell and hear at exactly the same moment. They can come right after each other and blend into each other, but there's a distinction between them. Another good example, for those of you who are old enough as I am, and used to go to these fun fairs when you were a kid, well, they used to have these machines, and used to call what the butler saw machines. You used to put a penny in the machine, and you turn the handle, it was just still shots which went quite fast and gave the illusion of movement. And before, you used to have the old, the great cinemas or TVs. It was just a way of giving the illusion of movement. But it's a simple cards, like a cartoon moving very quickly, gave you the illusion of continuity. But they were discrete pictures, moving very fast, giving the illusion, because consciousness would not be able to see the separations, the spaces in between, and would make up a continuity of action when they're just separate frames running together quite fast. That's what our sensory experience is like. And that's what consciousness is. Where have I got to now? And with the arising of formations, the mental formations, in particular here this means with the arising of will, there is the arising of consciousness. With the cessation of will, there's a cessation of consciousness. The way leading to the cessation of consciousness is just this Noble Eightfold Path. There's right view to right stillness. So here again, Buddha is saying quite clearly that to follow the Eightfold Path, and it makes your consciousness cease. That's what happens if you follow the Eightfold Path. Consciousness stops. Are you ready for that? The ceasing of consciousness. The formation, when a noble disciple, and the way leading to cessation of consciousness is the Eightfold Path, when a noble disciple has thus understood consciousness, its origin, cessation, the way leading to cessation, they here and now make an end of suffering. And that way too, a noble disciple is one of right views, right of this true Dhamma. Saying, good friends, amongst the light and rejoicing of Venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question, may there be another way? Yes. When a noble disciple understands his formations, this is Sankara. The origin, cessation, the way leads to the cessation of formations. That way the one of right view, one has arrived at this true karma, this true Dhamma. What are Sankaras, its origin, cessation, the way into the cessation? There are these three kinds of Sankaras, the bodily formations, verbal formations and mental formations, sometimes called bodily karma, verbal karma, mental karma. And the reason why I called it volitions was because the Buddha said the volition is at the heart of karma. That's its main aspect. Volitional actions by body, speech or mind. Creating consciousness. We'll come at this in a moment. There's something interesting here, which is a point which you can make when you understand what's going on. With the arising of ignorance, I prefer delusion, because you don't overcome this just through knowledge, you overcome this with understanding. So with the arising of delusion, there's the arising of sankharas. With the cessation of delusion, there's a cessation of these karma formations. The way leading to the cessation of the karma formations is the Eightfold Path, the right view to right concentration, or right stillness. When noble disciples thus understood formations, its origin, cessation, and the way into the cessation, they can now, here and now, make an end of suffering, and that way to a noble disciple is one of right views of the true Dhamma. So, if we can overcome these karma formations, and an arahat has overcome those karma formations, so they should have overcome, and maybe I'll just leave that argument just a little bit, a few more moments, until we go to the ignorance or delusion paragraph. Saying, good friend, amongst the light and rejoicing of Venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question, might there be another way to understand right view? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands delusion, this is avijja, the origin of delusion, the cessation of delusion, the way leading to the cessation of delusion, that way the one of right views arrived at the true Dhamma. And what is delusion? Its origin, its cessation, the way leading to the cessation of delusion. Not knowing about dukkha, not knowing about the origin of dukkha, not knowing about the cessation of dukkha, not knowing about the way into the cessation of dukkha. In other words, not knowing about the Four Noble Truths. This is called delusion. Do you know the Four Noble Truths? I'm sure you can tell me them exactly. You may even be able to recite them in Pali. In other words, you're knowledgeable about those Four Noble Truths, but if you really understood them, you'd have made an end of suffering. That's why I don't call it ignorance, I call it delusion. You're not ignorant about the Four Noble Truths, but you may not be able to understand them fully. That's why it's not ignorance, it's delusion. So delusion is not fully penetrating the Four Noble Truths. With the arising of these taints, we'll go into what these taints mean in a minute, I'll call them taints for the time being. There's the arising of delusion. The cessation of the taints is the cessation of delusion. The way leading to the cessation of delusion is just this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view to right concentration. When a noble disciple has thus understood delusion, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of delusion, they can here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, a noble disciple is one of right views, the right of this true Dhamma. So this is, you've got enlightened. You've overcome delusion. Now, I'm just going to go back to that argument, which I just went over very quickly a few moments ago. When delusion is ended, we all know, should know, that delusion is ended when you become an enlightened one. When you're an arahat, you're fully enlightened. So you've ended delusion. And they say over here in the formations, with the ending of delusion, with the cessation of delusion, is the cessation of formations. And you go to the one above there, with the cessation of formations, is the cessation of consciousness. So, it's a problem there. Because according to this, it says, with the cessation of delusion, there's a cessation of formations, the cessation of formations is the cessation of consciousness, which means with the cessation of ignorance or delusion, there's the cessation of consciousness. In other words, as soon as you become an enlightened person, you're unconscious straight away. Is that true? When a person becomes enlightened, when the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, was he unconscious for the next 45 years? So what is the solution to this problem? Come on. You all know this. Should do anyway. Is there a problem here? To say, cessation of delusion means a cessation of consciousness. Cessation of delusion occurs when you become enlightened. Ah, very good. Okay. You, top of the class. The cause and effect takes a lot of time. So, delusion is ended. So, the karma formations have ended. The karma formations are creating here the consciousness for the future life. That's the only explanation which makes sense for the arahat. You know you've ended delusion, ended the karma formations, and you know that consciousness will finish at their death, at their parinibbana. No more consciousness after that point. So many people, the Abhidharma here is correct. It causes consciousness, the rebirth linking consciousness. Well done. Has to be that way. So, delusion finishing, finishing the karma formations, finishing the consciousness in the next life. There is a time delay in cause and effect. When you overcome delusion, you become fully enlightened, you have to wait. In the Theragata, they had this beautiful phrase, a person who's become enlightened is like a workman or a workwoman waiting for their wages. They finish their job, they've knocked off work on Friday, and they've just got to wait because the check is in the mail. And it arrives at your death, the end of consciousness and everything else. So that's why they describe, the enlightened ones said that we're like workmen, finished our job, just waiting for our wages. So there is time delay here. And commentaries, I argue with the commentaries if they're not in accordance with the suttas, is correct. This is dependent origination. It is three life. You can't get away from that. The delusion formations, previous life, creating the consciousness in this life, creating all these other sensory experiences to the point of craving, taking up being and getting reborn again, creating a new birth, a new aging and death. But we go to the last one here, and then we have some discussion if necessary. The taints. Otherwise known as asavas, and my preferred translation is the outflowings. I love outflowings. Saying, good friends, the monks delighting rejoice in the venerable disciple's words, I ask him, may there be another way? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the outflowings, the origin of the outflowings, the cessation of the outflowings, and the way leading the cessation of the outflowings, in that way they are one of right view, whose view is straight, who is a perfect confidence in the Dharma has arrived at this true Dharma. Remember, these outflowings are creating delusion. And you know these outflowings. Anyone who's ever meditated before, you're staying in the present moment and the mind wants to flow out into the future or the past, anywhere other than right here. It wants to flow out into thoughts, wants to flow out into fantasies. It wants to go out from where you are, never to go in. The way of meditation is going against those outflows, going in to the center of things. But the nature of our mind is always to go out here and out there, never to actually to go in. So those outflowings, and you, when you're meditating, you can understand exactly what that means, because you can experience the outflowings of the mind. So what is the outflowings, its origin, cessation, and the way into the cessation of the outflowings? There are these three outflowings. The outflowing of sensory desire. You can understand you flow out to get that sensory desire. The outflowing of being. So going out, you're actually doing something, you're being something. Going inside, you feel you're disappearing. And the outflowing of delusion. You're thinking there might be something out there. It creates delusion. It is one of the great causes of the outflowings. With the arising of delusion is the arising of the outflowings. Remember, these outflowings also cause delusion. The cessation of delusion is the cessation of the outflowings. The way into cessation of the outflowings is again the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness and stillness. So when you get to the causality of things, and now you've actually gone to delusion is caused by these outflowings, outflowings is caused by delusion. You have to stop somewhere like that, where these two things support one another. In other cases, the Buddha actually stops at consciousness and nama-rupa. Here he goes a little bit deeper into delusion, causing the outflowings of the mind, outflowings of the mind being caused by delusion. Why can't we be still in meditation? Because we think that somewhere outside of here we can find truth, we can find meaning, we can find richness, we can find wisdom. Anything other than just right in here. That's our delusion which stops us seeing what's right in the middle of us. That's the outflowings of the mind. And the Buddha said the only way to get enlightened is to go against that stream. To go in rather than go out. And it's not an easy thing to do. You go so far and you bounce out again. Have you ever tried getting like two magnets of the same polarity and trying to push them together? Trying to get them close enough together, and always the closer they are, the more they react. That's actually what it's like going in. You go in and in, and you get so in, and it sort of pushes you out again. That's the power, the force of the outflowings. So that's what the outflowings are, and the way for their cessation is the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's wonderful, the Noble Eightfold Path knocks all of these things on the head. That's why it is the way to the end of everything. When a noble disciple has understood these outflowings, the origin, the cessation, the way into the cessation of the outflowings, they entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust. See, what do you want to lust for? Abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. What's the point of aversion? It's like being averse to a rock. It's there, being averse to it. It won't get rid of it. And it just creates suffering. It doesn't make any sense at all. You extirpate the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. Well, you've seen through that, if you understand what consciousness is. And also by not going outwards, by going inwards, you see all these things. And by abandoning delusion, arousing true knowledge, you here and now make an end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right view. His view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, because you experience it yourself. You hear these things and you understand, wow, that Buddha was amazing and so accurate. You arrived at the true Dhamma. You're a stream winner. Samsara is about to end for you. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words, as they should. That's a fantastic sutta. I don't usually speak about it because it takes a long time, so please excuse me for going on a bit longer than usual. Any comments? Yeah. Yeah, they have here the outflowings of sensory desire. This is actually what forces the mind out. Do you like a nice pizza? Maybe you've meditated now. Well, I could really do with a pizza now. It's really hot, a nice ice cream. You start thinking of you got out already. The outflowing of sensory desire. The outflowing of being. Just in deep meditation in here, but you're losing your sense of self. You're disappearing. So because you hate that, that is the deep force in those two magnets. When they come close together, you know, you're just going too close to non-existence, non-being. You just go out, anything, just to be. Equivalent, yeah, because you're getting too still. You want to do something just for the sake of, you know, yeah, I'm here. I'm not gone yet. So that's that one. And what was the other one? Of delusion. And, you know, it's because there's many types of delusion. For example, sometimes people get very still and they think there must be something going wrong here. They don't understand what's happening in their deep meditation when things are disappearing. Something's wrong. Ah, I'm vanishing. And sometimes it's not knowing. Sometimes they're afraid of what's going to happen when they let go a little bit more. That's why a little bit of experience of what happens. A bit of faith also. Knowledge from what's over here. Sometimes that can help enormously to overcome that barrier to go deep in meditation. So go against the outflowings when you understand why. So that's a delusion. I think that's the three delusions. So it's a... That's right, just the three. The arising of the taints. Those are the three. Okay, yes. Okay, just what has happened, the enlightened one, they've no more delusion. Because there's no more delusion. Even when they have any feelings, they will not sort of think those feelings can be controlled. They know there's pleasure, there's pain, that's part of life. So their craving, their wanting, will just be disappearing or disappeared. They won't take up anything. They won't take up these senses unless they really have to. So basically they'll just be letting go of things all the time until they really have to. The only reason which motivates the arahat, which keeps them going, is actually to serve the Dhamma, for the happiness and well-being of all other beings. That's the only thing. Liking and disliking are part of life, yes, liking and disliking, but they don't give it any other meaning. And when they sort of like something, they say, oh, this is just part of life, or they dislike it, it's just part of life. But they don't sort of make any clinging out of that, they don't take that up, they don't make a being of that, they understand completely what's going on. This is just consciousness. It's just what happens when you have consciousness, and you don't try and control it to get rid of it. If you like something or dislike it, you don't control it. Indeed, there's no sort of karma being made there. Okay, okay, one more, yeah. 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 Hmm. It is cyclic, yes. But we're trying to understand what is this right view. And the way leading to the end of suffering is the Eightfold Path. So it's tough. You've got to get that right view first of all. And that's a tough one to get. So you get the right view, the cause of attaining right view. It's not actually given here. It's in Mahavedala Sutta. So the cause of right view, two things. Is the words of another and yonisamanasikara, which is work of the mind which goes to the source of things. Those are the two causes of the attainment of right view. The words of another is just the words of an Aryan, someone who's at least a streamer, if not an arahat, someone who's actually seen the Dhamma, so they're speaking from personal experience, they can explain these things in a really full, deep way. So when you have that, you have the first requirement for being a stream winner. You've heard what the Dhamma is. Maybe you may not believe it. Maybe it may be beyond you, but, you know, saying there's no self in there. You know, you can see that this consciousness, why you're deluded thinking this consciousness is continuous. You know, what this uptaking is, how this whole thing works. You know, you've got the information, you know, from a knowledgeable being. That's the words of another. But that is not enough. You don't get in line just by listening to Dhamma. You've got to go to the source of things. Actually follow. What does that actually mean? And this word yonisa means literally going to the womb of things, the origin of things. And that is always the opposite of the outflowings. It's going in. That's what meditation's about. So you've got to go deep in meditation to the source of things. Go in. Deeper in to the origin. You know, you've heard me teach that simile, for example, the thousand petal lotus. You go to the center of that lotus by opening each flower, each petal in turn. That is the job of meditation. So the way to become enlightened, or the way to get that right view, is to listen, learn from good teachers, get the understanding. But once you have that understanding, you need the deep meditations. The deep understanding I sometimes call the gunpowder. The meditation is the match. You've got to have gunpowder, you've got to have a match to get the explosion of enlightenment. Just one without the other. You can be the greatest scholar in the world, listen to all the greatest teachers, but still you're not enlightened. You can be a very powerful meditator, but still not become enlightened. You need both. You need the words of another, of someone who's seen the Dhamma, and some deep meditation. Those two together, that's where you get right view. Yes? Certainly. Oh, there's Sariputta here, Ajahn Chah. These are sort of people, because this is actually even said by the Buddha, as a result of being enlightened. So you know that birth is ended. The cause has been uprooted. And they say that just as a lamp, this is from the Ratana Sutta, just like this lamp will burn out, just because the fuel is gone, so that this being is no longer subject to any more rebirth. The reason why you can actually see, understand just who you really thought you were. Why one always thought that one existed. See the whole cause and effect. You've seen everything very deeply. You know how it works. And you've actually seen the cause. And you've stopped that cause. Delusion has ended. Once you see the whole way it works, you know it cannot carry on. The seed has been destroyed. Kina Bija. That's what it says in the Ratana Sutta. What is it that Ratana Sutta? Some of you know that. Kinang puranang nawang nati sambhavang virata chitayati kebawasami te kina bija avivulhi chanda nibanti dira yatayang padipo. Now let's translate that for you. Kinang puranang nawang nati sambhavang. All that past has been destroyed. That's kina puranang. Nawang nati sambhavang. There is not any new stuff to come. Virata chitayati kebawasami. The mind has been liberated from existence. Shekhavasmi. Taking a bija avivulhi chanda. Having destroyed the seed, there is no more desire left. Nibanti dira yatayang padipa. Nibbana is certain, just like this lamp will go out. That's the last verse of the Ratana Sutta. If anyone wants to have a look at that. It's one of my favorite little verses, which we chant so regularly. It's very beautiful. So some of the things you actually chant here, if you actually look at their translations, or even better than translations, understand deeply what these words mean. Wow, they're powerful teachings. Really understand what the Buddha was saying, and it really inspires you. So that's what happens. You're ending things. But many people, when you talk like this, think, you're talking about destroying me. Yes. What was Ajahn Chah used to say when first time we used to come here? Have you come here to die? He didn't know what he meant. That's what he was meaning. We come here to finish with things. Not to die in just a physical sense, but to die in the spiritual sense. Not many people are ready for that. But I teach this, and this is what it says. The end of suffering. Are you ready for it? Anyway, it's up to you now. Okay, we've gone on for a long time, and I've got to go back to my monitor. You've got to go back home. So, let's finish off.